here at Savings, 09-3007 and 3996. Mr. Boyce.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is David Boyce, and I represent Emigrant Savings Bank. As I think the record is clear, in August of 2004, Emigrant Savings Bank contracted with Medavant to provide a computerized online banking system. There were a number of problems with that banking system. Both sides made an effort to correct the problems as they arose. Some of the problems were created were fixed. Some weren't. In May of 2006, Emigrant terminated the agreement. Medavant sued, claiming about $2 million of unpaid processing fees under the agreement, plus a termination fee. And the termination fee was either about $3 million or about $20 million, depending on whether Emigrant created an in-house system, in which case it was $3 million, or used a competitive system, or used their confidential information, in which case it was $20. Emigrant counterclaimed, and Emigrant said they breached the agreement. We had a right to terminate, and we're entitled to damages for the inadequate services that we got. During discovery, Emigrant found out that the representations that Medavant had made during the contract negotiations were simply false. They had said they had a proven system. They didn't. They said they had a scalable system. They didn't. They said they had a fully integrated system. They didn't. And so Emigrant amended to claim fraud and intentional misrepresentation. After a trial, the court found that there was no material breach by Medavant. It found that there was no right to terminate. There was a right to terminate, but not without a termination fee. And it held that there was no fraud because there had been no reliance, no justifiable reliance by Emigrant on the misrepresentations. We believe that there are four fundamental legal errors that the court made in dealing with the contract claim, and one fundamental legal error that the court made in dealing with the fraud and intentional misrepresentation claim. Before addressing those, I do, though, want to emphasize the complexity that's added to this appeal by virtue of the fact that the court made an oral set of findings, general findings, and then essentially adopted wholesale the findings that had been proposed by Medavant. Now, Medavant says, well, the judge didn't adopt all of our findings. He adopted all the findings that are on the issues on appeal. All of the findings that they proposed that relate to the issues that are before this court, that is, where they won, he simply adopted their findings essentially word for word. He added a reference to Black's Law Dictionary, but he adopted wholesale their findings, number one through over 100. Because those findings themselves are defective, this court doesn't really have the kind of basis that the court has often required district courts to provide it in terms of understanding exactly what the basis of the court's decision were.
Mr. Boyce, this Black's Law Dictionary definition, it was the commercially reasonable. You don't dispute that definition, do you?
We don't dispute that that is the definition that applies as a very, very generalized matter. I think the Black's Law Dictionary was relating to property, not computer systems.
Do you think it was inappropriate understanding of that term for Judge Stattmiller to use in making his findings?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that was the real error. The real error was that what the court did was it looked at commercial reasonableness by asking, was Emigrant successful as an online bank? And throughout the opinion, both the adopted Medavant findings and the oral opinion, what the court does is ask the question, was Emigrant successful in its online banking? Not were the services provided by Medavant commercially reasonable. And the reason that that's a very important difference is that one of the things that happened here is that emigrant, through a lot of time, effort, and money, worked around the problems. They came in and did things manually that were supposed to be done automatically. They had an $18 million advertising campaign, an advertising campaign that cost more than the system. They mailed out thousands of paper applications to try to deal with the inadequacies of the Metavant system, and they lost a lot of customers. All of those things are undisputed.
Wasn't it projected that going in there'd be this customer loss? Any sort of program like that has some sort of slippage of applicants. It seemed to me there was something your 25 projected 25%.
Well, that projection was something that was in, as the judge says, two of the iterations of the contract, but not in the final contract. That was not in the final contract. The second thing to remember about that is that talks about people that are going to fall off, not people that are blocked out because the system fails. That 25% figure had nothing to do with failures of the Metavant system. That was simply projected as to what would happen in terms of the commercial implementation of that system if it worked. Here you had a system that didn't work. It allowed people to withdraw more than they deposited, something that there's no dispute. Nobody knew about that when we signed the contract. That's a pretty basic failure in a banking system. Now, there is a dispute as to when they told us about it. Our witnesses, who the court, in its oral opinion, found credible, said we found out about it in December. They say no, there were some indications and documents going back to September. But there's no dispute that nobody knew that at the beginning, and there can be no dispute that that's not an adequate banking system. That's not a commercially reasonable banking system. And there is no dispute in the record that what Immigrant did was came up with all sorts of manual workarounds to try to avoid the problems that were created by the fact that you did not have an automatic way of preventing people from withdrawing more. Now, in addition to that, there were thousands of customers who tried to sign up for accounts, but the system wouldn't let them. There were thousands of situations in which there were attempted to be ACH, the computerized check clearinghouse transactions, that couldn't be processed because the system failed. Not the system wasn't available. This is not a question of whether it was up and running. It was a question of whether the system was properly running, whether it was adequately commercially reasonable to process those transactions. A banking system has got to be able to process check clearinghouse transactions. A banking system can't allow you to withdraw more than you have. A banking system has got to allow people who are trying to sign up accounts to sign up for those accounts online if it's a computerized system. This was a situation in which all of these failures existed. But what the court held was that because Emigrant was successful, and they were very successful in their online banking system, they had a lot of reasons for that. Their advertising campaign helped. The fact that they were paying the highest amount of interest of anybody helped. The fact that they were the first to market with a combination of both a bricks and mortar and an online banking system helped. All of those things contributed to it. There was simply no basis for the court to conclude that there was not problems with the system, that there were not breaches. But the court says those don't matter because Emigrant was successful. Now, the court also says...
Well, doesn't the overall success, which was spectacular by their initial estimates, isn't that some reflection that the system got the job done?
No, Your Honor, because what you have to ask is what did that success come from? And would the success have been greater if they'd had a system that really worked? I mean, the fact that you can succeed by spending a lot of money to correct through manual workarounds, through advertising, for the commitment of in-house people, so that you continue to grow the business and do so spectacularly, doesn't mean that you haven't gotten a product that doesn't work properly, that breaches the covenants of commercial reasonableness that were in the contract. And you've got a situation here in which, with respect, we think the court below just got it wrong and judged it exclusively on whether or not Emigrant was a success, not looking at the question of whether or not the system itself that was being supplied was commercially reasonable. Even their expert admitted that he could not testify about the technical aspects of the system, whether the system was technically commercially reasonable. All he looked at was the accounts and the deposits. He said they got a lot of new accounts, they got a lot of deposits. That must mean that they're achieving their business objectives. And he defined that as being commercially reasonable. And the problem is that that simply doesn't fit, doesn't square with what the contract says. Now, a second legal error that we think is there is that the court ruled that because there was not a demand to cure, Emigrant couldn't terminate. And because Emigrant couldn't terminate, they couldn't get damages. Now, that second point is nowhere in the law, nowhere in the contract. It's contrary to Wisconsin law. Just because there's not a right to terminate doesn't mean that you don't have a right to get damages for breaches. Even if a breach is not a material breach, you have a right to get damages for that breach. And so when you've got clear evidence of breaches, whether or not that gives rise to a right to termination or not, it gives rise to a right to get damages for those breaches. With respect to the right of termination, the contract did not require a demand for a cure. It simply required notice of termination. They then got 30 days to cure. There is no dispute that there were problems that went on beyond that 30-day period. And that, under the contract, in terms of the termination clause, we believe is dispositive. Now, the fourth legal error with respect to the contract claim is that the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, we say, is implied in every Wisconsin contract. This court has previously held that in a number of cases. The court said, contrary to what the court had actually said in the summary judgment opinion, that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing cannot add any new obligations. It is true it cannot contradict specific obligations, but the whole point of a covenant of good faith and fair dealing is to add something that may not be explicit in the contract. And here, the evidence was clear that they knew about problems. They knew about problems with tech knowledge. They knew about problems with their subcontractors. They knew about problems with outages. They didn't tell Emigrant. The evidence
were they resolving those problems along the way that they knew about?
When they knew about the problems, when they found out about the problems, they tried to resolve them. When Medevant found out about the problems, they tried to resolve them. But what they didn't do is tell Emigrant as soon as they knew about the problems. So what Emigrant did was found out about these problems, found out about outages, found out about people not being able to sign up accounts from their customers. Customers would call in and complain. If Emigrant had known about the problems when they knew about the problems, Emigrant could have worked more effectively to solve those problems. And we say the concealment of that information was a violation of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The district court, in its holding that under Wisconsin law there is no covenant of good faith and fair dealing that imposes any obligation that is not expressly found in the four squares of the document, we think is simply wrong. Now, let me turn just briefly to the intentional misrepresentation claim. The court, in its oral opinion, held that there was not justifiable reliance because Emigrant did not investigate. As we've indicated in the brief, Wisconsin law, we believe, is very clear that there is no duty to investigate unless there's something on the face of the representation that causes you to have a duty of inquiry. Here, they claimed, and if you look at SA 125, There's a document there that contained the representations in March of 2005. If you look at SA 606 and 607, that's testimony from their witness in which they admit that they represented that they had a proven system, that they didn't, that they had a scalable system, that they didn't, that they had a fully integrated system, but they didn't. They took out of drafts of the contract, internal drafts, references to technology because they knew that that would alert us. We didn't find out about that until after the contract was signed. You had a whole series of misrepresentations. And the court says, but you might have been able to find this out if you'd investigated. Well, the problem is that there was no reason to investigate. There was no notice that we had to investigate. Under Wisconsin law, there is not that duty that the court found. We think that's a simple question of Wisconsin law. Did the court get it right or not? Now, on appeal, Medivant says, well, even if the judge got the reliance wrong, there are other elements of fraud that weren't proven. The problem with that is that's not the basis of the judge's findings. The judge, in his findings, simply related it to reliance. It is true that when he adopted their findings, their conclusory findings, there are findings about lack of intent and the like. But there is no findings that allow this court to determine what the basis of those findings were. There's nothing in there that allows this court to say, we know that they knew about technology's failings, and they didn't tell Immigrant. They admitted that. Their expert admitted that. There's nothing in the findings that suggests, well, why doesn't that indicate knowledge on their part? Why isn't that intentional? There is nothing in the record of the findings, because he simply adopted their findings, that demonstrates any chain of reasoning, any way that this court can determine whether or not that is a sensible approach or not. I see my light.
Are you essentially saying this case has to be retried?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm afraid I am.
And are you going to address the attorney's fee issue?
We've addressed that in our brief, Your Honor.
At length.
At length. I'm happy to answer any questions the court has on that. Two simple points. The judge found that we got the bills that they actually paid. Not true. They paid bills that were unredacted that showed what happened. We didn't see those.
Did you seek to discover them? Did you request them? Try to depose anybody? Get any documents?
We did not take discovery, but we did ask to have the bills that were actually paid. We asked to get ourselves to examine the bills that they received and paid. Also, Your Honor, there is the question of we succeeded on their largest claim. Their largest claim was for the $20 million termination fee. We are at least entitled to know which of those bills related to their failed claim. We can't tell that from what we got.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Garcia? Are you and Mr. Bloomer splitting it with respect to the merits and the attorney's fee issue?
The court will permit us to do that. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Paul Garcia on behalf of Medivant. Some pronounce it Medivante in the record as well. I, along with my partner, Andrew Bloomer, we had the high honor of trying this case before Judge Stattmuller over the course of 2 weeks. And, of course, it's always a privilege and an honor to appear in this court. And as Your Honor just pointed out, I will handle the merits issues, and time permitting, Mr. Bloomer will handle any fees questions. I'd like to begin where Mr. Boies left off toward the end, and that's with respect to fraud and the other elements, Your Honor, because this is a fundamental point, I think, that we emphasized in our brief on a number of occasions. And at page 13, footnote 4, Emigrant kind of gave it the back of their hand with respect to the other elements of fraud, and that is that they focus, to the exclusion of the other elements that the district court did find, with the support of substantial evidence, intent, reasonable reliance, were they in fact representations of fact with the intent to deceive and so forth. And if you look back at the pages that Emigrant says where they did raise a challenge to all these findings, pages 36 to 38 of their opening brief, I invite the court to take a fresh look at that, because those pages don't remotely challenge the other elements. Their brief focuses exclusively on the issue of reasonable reliance. And for that reason alone, Your Honors, the fraud finding should be affirmed. This is really a contract case. Judge Stattmuller intimated that on a number of occasions, and so I'd like to go to the heart of that, if I could, please. Your Honor, Judge Tinder touched on this with one of the first questions, and that is that all of the issues, and Judge Mannion as well with your question, that the parties were trying to fix these things, every single issue that Emigrant cites, Your Honors, every single one of them was specifically contemplated and expected. The issues with failed applications, the issues with outages and downtime and so forth, it's specifically contemplated by this agreement. Indeed, Your Honors, all the issues that Emigrant raises on appeal, every single one of them, fall squarely within the service levels under the agreement. And that is case dispositive on the issue of commercial reasonableness, because the contract says in no uncertain terms, if the service levels cover it, that's satisfactory performance, and the performance warranty separate and apart from that doesn't apply. That is game, set, and match, Your Honors, with respect to commercial reasonableness, because as I'll touch on in a moment, it is undisputed on this record that the service met levels were met and exceeded. So let's talk why the service levels, all the issues fall within the service levels. Emigrant says that the service levels only apply to outage, to downtime. Mr. Boyce says it doesn't cover whether or not the system is, quote, properly running, he just said now. I invite again the court's close read of the e-banking service level at K23 of the contract, which defines availability is not just when the system is down, but also when it's not responsive. It says available and responsive to what the customer does. So it includes things like it's sluggish or not running properly. It covers exactly the issues that they're raising. Mr. Paschke testified on behalf of Medavante on the first day, pages 41 to 42 and 6871, that these responsive issues, the sluggishness, fall squarely and are measured by the service levels. Any issues with respect to software and hardware that pertain to online account applications and so forth fall squarely within the service levels. Mr. Paschke testified to that at Emigrant Separate Appendix, page 266. The issues with respect to this subcontract, technology, Your Honors, pertains precisely to online account creation, the OAC OAC, that everybody agreed fall within the service levels. The district court found it at Emigrant Appendix 56, paragraph 51. Emigrant agreed. Mr. Niebel, their expert, at Medavante Appendix 710, and substantial evidence supported it. Mr. Paschke, for example, at Medavante Appendix 513 and 516 to 517. So all these issues with respect to failed applications, technology, a subcontractor problem, all fall within the service levels that were met and satisfied and deal with commercial reasonableness. Indeed, the contract necessarily assumes and addresses the issue of failed applications, Your Honors. 2% downtime on the OAC application, for example, necessarily means that thousands of applications are not going to get through. The contract specifically covers it. And indeed, Your Honor, Judge Tinder mentioned the 25% assumed application failure rate for any reason, whether it was a problem, whether or not it was somebody to go get a sandwich, whether or not somebody tuned out to watch a television show. That was the assumption going into the contract. So it absolutely was the baseline for how these issues were being addressed. I also invite the court's attention to section 4.5 of the agreement, which defines these e-banking services as all the things customers do from their personal computer to access the account, to collect data, to initiate transactions like deposits and so forth. All the interactions with the customers opening the accounts are covered by the service level. Mr. Paschke again testified to that at Medavante Appendix 510 to 511. So everything that Emigrant is complaining about with respect to performance and services falls squarely flat in the middle of the service levels, not some separate performance warranty. And again, that's case dispositive on the issue of commercial reasonableness, because the contract at Section 4.4 says plain as day, if you meet the service levels, that's satisfactory performance. And Section 6.1, if the service level pertains to it or covers it, then the commercial reasonable warranty doesn't apply. And Medavante met or exceeded the service levels in no uncertain terms. The district court found it, Emigrant agreed, and overwhelming evidence supported it. And I could give the citations there in our brief as well. So the district court, based on that abundant evidence, found that the services were commercially reasonable, both with respect to the service levels and even separate and apart from the service levels. The judge found that Medavante performed in good faith, as Judge Mannion asked, worked to correct the issues. In fact, Mr. Boies even said that they worked together to try to fix things as they came up, as they were contemplated to do. Of course, that's fundamentally in conflict with their claim of fraud, which is that we weren't doing what we were trying to do and weren't trying to fix things as they came up. I also invite the court's attention to determining the question of commercial reasonableness in the proper context. Emigrant is focusing on one sliver of the whole range of services that Medavante provided. They're focusing really on the commercial e-banking, the consumer e-banking application, which is only one of the seven services. Their expert didn't even look at the other services to see whether or not we were doing a good job there. And the record is plain as day as well there, and substantial, that we were doing a knockdown job with respect to all the services. So even if they were right with this sliver, if they don't look at it in the proper context of all the services we provided, again, that fails just as a matter of law. And Judge Tinder, you asked another critical question with respect to that, and that is the commercial reasonableness as compared to others. Judge Stattmuller applied Black's Law Dictionary to measure performance as to how it was doing compared to others in the industry. And just a fundamental failure of proof there, Emigrant didn't compare our services to anybody else's services to show if they weren't up to snuff or weren't up to what is commercially acceptable. Of course, Your Honors, Emigrant could have compared these services that we provided over the course of 19 months to other services. They could have compared it to their own replacement system. Indeed, they have their own system running from July of 2006 or August of 2006 forward. They could have measured outages, downtime, failed applications. Indeed, we moved to compel. If we said, if our services are so bad, let's see how they were doing to their replacement system. And they resisted that motion. So they had every evidence at their fingertips if they wanted to show commercial unreasonableness, and they chose not to use it. I submit, Your Honors, this record is just overwhelming on the issue of commercial reasonableness. And another question that the court asked with respect to the overall performance, doesn't that give us some insight into commercial reasonableness? And see, the answer to that is a resounding yes. In fact, the district court specifically found that Emigrant would not have been able to achieve this success were it not for the exceptional services that Medavante provided. That's at Emigrant Appendix 60, paragraph 71. Substantial evidence supported that finding, Your Honors. Mr. Paschke testified at Medavante Appendix 488 that the system couldn't have done what it done, it couldn't have opened all these accounts, couldn't have processed millions of transactions, couldn't have accepted billions of dollars of deposits were our services not up to snuff. Mr. Hurtis testified to it at Medavante Appendix 523. The record is replete with a mountain of evidence. In fact, their own expert, Your Honors, Mr. Niebel, disavowed any opinion that our services were commercially reasonable in the context of this outstanding performance. That's at Medavante Appendix 674. It was a huge success. If you walked into this courtroom and heard Mr. Boies' argument, you'd think this was a train wreck, that the system fell apart and it didn't work. This was a success by any measure. If I could turn for just a moment to the misrepresentation argument that Mr. Boies made. He's identified three, that it was a proven system, integrated, and scalable. And on each of those, the district court found that it was scalable, that it was integrated. Emigrant Appendix 62, paragraph 82, on both scores. We had abundant experience that we represented to them. And the with respect to the one application of online accounts, the proposals way back in March of 2004 indicated they were projects and initiatives, Medavante Appendix 401, that were developing the system, Medavante Appendix 340, that were about to launch a direct bank with respect to Capital One, Emigrant Separate Appendix 123. So the fraud claims are illusory. The district court made abundant findings there, Your Honors. The good funds, or the automatic balance check, is a real head-scratcher. This had to do with whether or not there was an automatic system to check the account balance before a transaction occurred. And here, Your Honors, Emigrant wanted to get to market fast. That was their overriding and primary concern. They wanted to get to market in 6 months. We got them there in five. They expected extremely low volumes of accounts. Your Honors saw the projections in the contract. And so they didn't want to spend the money to implement this system that ended up costing $150,000, which, by the way, Medavante gave them for free when they complained about it. And it's undisputed that it was a safe and sound system before this was launched to the public. Emigrant Appendix 53, paragraph 37. Emigrant agreed with it. Emigrant's banking regulation expert agreed with it. And, indeed, when they reaffirmed the contract on December 14th, they knew about this lack of an automated feature, but they reapproved it anyway. That's at contract 36. And again, on February 1st of 2005, they knew that this system didn't have the automatic feature, yet they signed the contract again. And indeed, Your Honors, each of the complaints that they make, they were aware of by the time September or October of 2005 comes around. And here the district court made a finding that this maybe was the best evidence on commercial reasonableness. That is, after all these supposed problems in January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August of 2005, Emigrant comes to Medavante and they say, your services are so good that we want to do the same product, the same system for business accounts, not just consumer accounts. That just makes no sense if supposedly the system were no good from the very beginning, and obviously so. Now, Emigrant says in their reply brief, well, we were in for a penny, in for a pound, so we were kind of stuck. We had to stay with Medavante at this point. But that certainly doesn't have anything to do with expanding the business to new business accounts, where, of course, there would be more issues with volume, more issues with scalability, more issues with integration. So the district court was absolutely right to rely on that as solid evidence, a damning admission, Your Honors, on the issue of commercial reasonableness.
They claim that there was, because of this $18 million advertising expenditure and the high interest rate offered on the deposits, that they overcame the shortcomings, and that's why it was successful, and therefore the court shouldn't have based its decision on success.
Your Honors, Judge Manning, that's a very good question, and I certainly appreciate it. It stands to reason that the interest rates had something to do with it. It stands to reason that their advertising had something to do with it. But it also stands to reason that it would have been able to do what it did if it were not for absolutely outstanding performance. And it, Judge Stattmuller found there was a partnership and collective effort to get to that success. So certainly those things played into it. If they had offered, 1% interest, probably wouldn't have attracted as many accounts, and then we wouldn't have any of the volume issues and the success to that level, certainly. But by no stretch, Your Honor, does that mean that the services weren't up to snuff, because it took the services to be able to handle all the volume that occurred. So it's unreasonable for Emigrant to suggest that all the success is due to them, none of the success is due to us. That just doesn't stand up to the record, doesn't stand up to Judge Stattmuller's abundant findings. If I could touch just for a moment, please, on the duty to investigate. Judge Stattmuller didn't impose any burden on Emigrant to investigate or to look under rocks or to find things that weren't apparent to them. What he clearly found on each occasion and if the court looks at each of the oral statements he makes, he's talking about things that were readily already known to emigrants. For example, the fact that subcontractors were included in every draft of the agreement. And they found out the name of the subcontractor September of 2004. They re-upped the contract in December of 2004 and again in February 2005. All of the issues they talk about, Your Honors, were readily apparent to them. Now, if I could, I'd like to just take a moment and talk about the big picture, because this really is the starting point for emigrants' argument, and that is that Judge Stattmuller essentially followed the siren song of proposed findings and didn't engage in independent thinking or look at the record in a hard way. And, Your Honors, I submit to you that that is just absolutely unsupported by this record. Judge Stattmuller provided helpful additional oral comments to supplement the findings that were annotated and cited specific evidence. Of all the district court judges in this circuit, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on any judge in this circuit, the thought that Judge Stattmuller didn't come to his own conclusions is really not supported by the record. The court should have full and high confidence that Judge Stattmuller independently gave this a hard look. Sure, he adopted findings in chunks, but they were annotated. I realize I'm spilling into Mr. Bloomer's time. Perhaps he'll indulge me with just a couple of more minutes. One of the cases cited in the record, actually it's cited in one of the cases, it cited the Supreme Court's Anderson v. Vessemer, North Carolina. The Supreme Court said it's perfectly appropriate, for example, to announce a conclusion, invite findings by the parties, allow objections, and then to adopt them in that way. And particularly where we have the additional insight by Judge Stattmuller of his rationale that went above and beyond what the parties had argued, that went above and beyond what was cited, starting, for example, with the Black's Law Dictionary. Judge Stattmuller clearly said at Emigrant Appendix 15 to 16 that he reviewed both sides' proposed findings and conclusions in great detail and gave them both careful consideration. He said at Appendix EA 16 that they were merely his starting point. He had them for almost a week before closing arguments, and then he heard a full day of closing arguments. He took another 13 days before he issued his ruling on June 3rd of 2009. I submit to you, Your Honors, that Judge Stattmuller did exactly what the court should want district court judges to do. He went above and beyond the call of duty in analyzing the record, coming to his own conclusion. And to get to the heart of Judge Mannion's question, the thought of retrying this case would be not only against the great weight of the evidence and the record, but a real travesty on this record. The thought of trying this case again with all these abundant findings and this abundant evidence of good, solid performance. If the court has no further questions, let me just touch base, if I could, on this duty of good faith. Judge Stattmuller got that exactly right as well. He was merely saying, and he did say, that if there was something extra contractual that didn't fill in the gaps of what was required, that the duty of good faith does not create an obligation above and beyond what was contemplated in the agreement. And indeed, this thing of telling them of errors, I invite the court's attention there to the contract agreement, section 16.3. It was emigrants' obligation to look for the mistakes and to report them, even though both sides were watching this real time and dealing with them as they came. So that is a direct conflict with the provision of the agreement. Your Honors, I submit to you that you ought to have the utmost confidence that this was exactly right, what Judge Stattmuller did, and it was based on abundant evidence after a careful look at the record, and I ask you to affirm, and I will yield the remaining time to Mr. Bloomer.
And how much remaining time is there? 5 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let me acknowledge and repeat my partner's statement that it's an honor to appear before this court, just as it was to appear before Judge Stattmuller over the two-week trial. May it please the court. Judge Tinder, to answer your question that you asked, Mr. Boies, whether there was a request on the fee petition for the daily entries by was there a request by Emigrant to Medavante? The answer is no, and perhaps that's not surprising because there is no law, there's no rule, there's no case, there's no requirement that daily entries be provided.
Mr. Bloom,
yes.
Perhaps you could help me on page 18 of the appellant's brief on the fees case. They talk about the fact that the bill submitted to the district court and to them were not the bills that had been originally submitted by counsel to Medevet. Is that true?
Your Honor, they were the bills submitted to Medavante. They were an excerpt of the entire bill. So what was provided to the district court and what was provided to Emigrant showed the each individual attorney for each month, showed each individual attorney who or other individual who worked on the matter, the number of hours, the billing rate, the costs, the individual totals for each attorney, and the aggregate totals. What was not provided was the underlying daily entries. And let me anticipate your next question, which is why. And the answer is we're in a case, Your Honors, where we prevailed on $240 million-plus out of a $255 million claim, and we are up in the Court of Appeals fighting over who the prevailing party is. Every issue in this case has been litigated to a T. We would be, if we had provided the daily entries, we would have had precisely the ancillary litigation, the satellite litigation, the detailed review and dispute and fight.
Did Medavante's general counsel receive the same bill that was eventually presented to the district court?
He did, Your Honor, and he received more. I mean, he received the daily entries. The bills, as they, the bills have the totals by month for each attorney and the cost, and then they have in successive pages the detailed daily entries. What was provided, the client got all of it. What the district court and what Emigrant got was the first few pages, which show the summaries, but not the daily
entries.
Now, if
Medcom is based on the rationale that we don't have to look at this line by line because it is the contractual arrangement of the parties, it is what the marketplace, if you want, will tolerate. It sounds like Medavante's general counsel was not willing to tolerate receiving the same information the district court wanted. Medavante's counsel wanted, general counsel wanted more before he paid the bill.
He did get more, Your Honor. There's no dispute about that.
And apparently inquired on occasion as to what had actually been done. Wanted more specific information about some entries.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the issue of the detail of bills, as this court has held in Medcom and in the Synthroid marketing case, the issue of detail, whether it's a 1,000-page bill or a one-line bill, is an issue for the client. There's no dispute in this case that what was presented to the client found commercially reasonable and paid. So that should, I think, under this court's precedence, that disposes of the issue of the detail. But the practical reason, given the way this case was litigated, and it was hotly contested on every issue, is we would have found ourselves precisely in the land that Medcom, that Balcor, that any number of this court's cases say counsel and courts are not supposed to be. And
because we assumed in Medcom that the receiving client doesn't want all that detail. Is that true? Is that a true assumption? Is that a valid assumption in the reality of today's law practice?
I think it depends on the client. For some it is, and for some it's
not.
Put
your finger up to the wind. Your times are changing, aren't they?
I have clients that do it differently even today, Your Honor. But I think what this court has held is the question of detail, to the extent it's an issue, gets decided by the client. If the client gets the one-line bill and pays it, that's commercially reasonable. If the client,
here the client wanted more than the one line. He got more than the one line.
Your Honor, he certainly got it. So the question before this court is the way that Judge Stattmuller did this, does it constitute clear error when there is no rule, no law? And on top of it, I would submit, Your Honors, that he had more evidence in front of him than MedCom requires. He had the declarations of inside and outside counsel. He had evidence in those declarations of a 10% discount that was frozen as of rates in 2008, September 1st of 2008. He had evidence of write-offs, none of which was contested. And so what I would submit, Judge Ripple, and to the court, is that, in fact, this court had in front of it more evidence than MedCom requires. And we're not asking for a bright-line rule. I think our opponents across the bar are asking for a bright-line rule. But that bright-line rule, if the court were to say you must submit daily entries, would rewrite this court's decisions in Synthroid Marketing, would rewrite MedCom, would rewrite Rule 54, which leaves this matter up to the discretion of the district court.
Is MedCom correct under the Erie Doctrine?
I believe so, Your Honor. I think
why?
This court
is a state case, right, under state contract law?
What the court held in MedCom as well as in Taco Bell, what this court held is that whether, for instance, a party is a prevailing party is a question of state law, but that the determination and method for determining whether a commercially reasonable fee is a procedural issue for federal law. And
you said that in Taco Bell, but I'm asking you, is that correct, given the Supreme Court's rulings in cases like Gasparini and the cases that have followed that?
I believe it is, Your Honor. My review of the case law indicates that whether you look in this circuit or in other circuits,
What have the other circuits said about MedCom? Have they followed it?
Other circuits have cited and followed MedCom. I would say
who has followed it?
I believe the Eighth Circuit has, Your Honor. But I would have to go back and confirm that. What I would say, Your Honor, is that other courts have treated the issue of determining the proof necessary for a reasonable attorney's fee is a procedural matter governed by the federal law of that circuit.
In effect, we made up a federal rule without going through the rules process.
I think we'd have to go back and look at what this court cited in Taco Bell and other cases, but I would submit, Your Honor, that it's a fairly well-established rule. And I'll admit, the
circuit doesn't follow it, does it?
No, but the Fifth Circuit has, as I think all circuits have, acknowledged that this issue is first and foremost an issue for the district court because you do have fairly flexible procedures under Rule 54 that say what gets submitted, how it gets submitted, what gets required is up to the district court. And in this case, Judge Stattmuller clearly knew that. If he had wanted the additional material or thought it was necessary, he could certainly have asked for it. And I will go back and check on the Eighth Circuit reference point. I don't want to leave the panel with any misimpression. It was a question I didn't anticipate. We've cited in our briefs other courts that I think are entirely consistent with MedCom. And
you've been very helpful, Mr. Bull.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Boyce, how much time remaining? 7 minutes, if you feel you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, let me deal with what counsel says is game, set, and match, which is he says the service levels control here. And he says the service levels are more than just availability. That is quite contrary to what his own witnesses says. Now, he quoted Mr. Paschke, one of his witnesses, and I asked the court to look at the record, SA 265 at lines 14 to 266, line 9. And there, Mr. Paschke directly says that the availability is not equivalent to performance levels. That same point was made by their expert, Mr. Moffitt. And I asked the court to look at Moffitt at SA 665. And again, Moffitt at 674, 676 to 677, 680 to 81. At 677, Moffitt, their expert, is asked whether he wouldn't agree that Medavant is acknowledging on a daily basis there are many failed applications that are not registering on the SLAs, the service levels, because there are no outages. Answer, yes, they are not included in the SLA because the system is not out. That was the undisputed evidence below. And one of the problems with the district court simply adopting their conclusory findings, you can't look beyond that. You can't find out what the district court's reasoning was in arriving at that. But the evidence here is absolutely clear that the service levels only covered the availability. It didn't cover these other things. And Moffitt himself, their expert, testifies that immigrant has lost business. They've lost business because of problems other than the availability issue. He admits that. So the idea that somehow these service levels trump all the other problems simply has no support anywhere in the record. Now, he says you'd thought it was a train wreck if you listened to me. Well, Your Honor, don't just listen to me. Listen to what Medavant was saying internally. They called it their performance, quote, awful, close quote, SA 163. Substandard, close quote, SA 180. A, quote, nightmare, close quote, SA 209. Over and over again, and we cite a lot more in our brief, they admitted their own failings at the time. They claimed that because immigrant was successful, that is sufficient to overcome the substandard system that they gave us. There is no basis in the record to find that that's so. We believe that that is a clear error of law. We're not saying that our performance couldn't be a factor to consider. The court didn't treat it as a factor to consider. The court treated it as the sine qua non. The only issue was, were we successful or not? And the court made no findings about what the reasons for those success were. The court made no findings that it wasn't due to the interest rates, to the advertising, to the manual workarounds, to the additional people that we hired. All the things that are in there undisputed in the record. Now, if the court had gone through and made findings on those specific issues, we'd have a different argument. But as the record now stands, there simply is no basis either in the findings or in the record to dispute their own statements and the evidence that what we got was a substandard product and that the success was due to the factors other than just the fact that we had the product. Could we have been more successful? I think the answer is clearly yes, and even their expert agrees to that. Could we? Did their system contribute? Absolutely. It was a system. It wasn't a perfect system. It wasn't the system we asked for. It wasn't the system we contracted for. We're entitled to get the damages for the breach. The fact that they gave us some part of a system and some parts work. He says, well, we're only complaining about the parts that didn't work. That's true. There were parts that worked. But the parts that didn't work, we're entitled to get damages for. And the idea that you can have a banking system, remember, they promised us a proven, integrated, fully scalable banking system. He even admits those were promises. A system that allows you to withdraw more than you've got is not a proven functioning banking system. The fact that it got fixed doesn't mean that it wasn't a breach for them not to have it when they were supposed to have it. The fact that there were fixes for some of these but not all of them does not mean that there were not problems that we are entitled to compensation for. Now, he does not address the issue with respect to the fact that all of the other elements of fraud that he claims there are findings on were not in the court's oral opinion. Those are simply the ones that are part of the conclusory findings that Medavant drafted and the court adopted wholesale. And there is nothing in the record, and he didn't tell you anything in the record that supported any of those findings or any subsidiary findings of the court that allows you to understand how you could have a finding that says there was not an intent to deceive when the evidence is They knew they didn't have a proven system. They knew they didn't have a scalable system. And they knew they didn't have a fully integrated system. They knew there were problems with technology, but they never told us. I went through this before. We went through it in a brief. I won't repeat it. But there were numerous instances where their own internal documents say one thing about technology, and they're saying something else to us about technology. Nothing in the court's findings explains why that isn't evidence that they knew what they were saying to us was not true. We think that in terms of the fraud claim, the only basis for the court's decision was the absence of reliance. That we've demonstrated, and essentially they've conceded this here, that there was simply no basis to make us investigate. There was no absence of a reasonable reliance when they came in and told us these things. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.